I want you to do something for a second. Whether you are, walking the dog, commuting on a train, or just sitting at your desk right now, I want you to look at the device you are using to listen to this.
Just take a real look at it.
Exactly. Go ahead and look at it. That little slab of glass and silicon in your hand, or, those wireless drivers in your ears. We treat them like ordinary utilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a toaster or a flashlight.
Right. Just a mundane, everyday object.
Yeah. But the physical object is really just a terminal. The reality is that this single device is your direct, permanent tether to a global power structure that honestly operates with an authority historically reserved for sovereign nations.
It's wild to think about. It fundamentally changes how we even understand the concept of a state. I mean, we carry these terminals everywhere, completely surrendered to their utility.
Oh, for sure. We never leave them behind.
But we rarely pause to map out the sheer scale of the architecture sitting on the other side of that glass. You know, we are interacting with systems that process billions of human decisions a second.
Billions. A second.
Yeah. They are routing global commerce, filtering public knowledge, and basically altering human behavioral patterns on a species-wide scale.
And that transition of power is exactly what we are dissecting today in this deep dive.
Yeah.
We are pulling directly from Dossier Trump 2015-2029, specifically Chapter 7, which covers the power of big tech.
It's a fascinating section.
It really is. Our mission today is to understand how we moved from a world run by physical industries to a world governed by digital gatekeepers.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for the longest time, power was something you could literally drop on your foot.
Precisely. If you look at the architecture of global power for, well, the vast majority of the 20th century, it was defined by atoms, not bits.
Right, like physical stuff.
Exactly. Economic and societal dominance belonged to heavy industry. We're talking about the extraction and logistics of oil, the forging of steel, the mass assembly lines of the automotive industry.
Like the banks, right? The massive physical vaults.
Right, legacy banking institutions. Power was incredibly tangible. You measured a nation's influence by its miles of railroad track or its barrels of crude produced per day or just raw industrial output.
But then, in what feels like a geopolitical blink of an eye, I mean, really just the first couple of decades of the 21st century, that entire framework just got flipped upside down.
Completely inverted.
Power stopped being heavy. It became weightless. It became like a line of code, a proprietary algorithm, or a hyper-cooled server farm sitting in the middle of a desert somewhere.
And that weightlessness is exactly what allowed it to scale so rapidly. I mean, think about it. A steel mill takes years to build.
Oh, yeah, and tons of capital.
Right, and it's bound by physical geography. But a piece of software, that can be distributed to 2 billion people overnight at essentially zero marginal cost.
Which is just mind-blowing when you really compare the two.
It is. This shift created entities with a reach that no industrial baron could have ever even dreamed of. Which, you know, brings us to the central tension of the dossier.
Right, the big question. How much power should a private, centralized technology company be allowed to wield within a functioning democratic society?
Exactly. And the perspectives in the source material are totally fractured on this.
Oh, they are completely polarized.
Right.
Because nobody elected these CEOs to run the global town square.
No, they didn't. And the critics look at this landscape and see a massive systemic risk. They see a handful of board members, you know, sitting in California making opaque decisions.
Decisions that can crater a foreign economy or silence a political movement.
Right, or completely rewrite the rules of global commerce without any traditional democratic oversight.
But then on the flip side, the proponents in the dossier point to the undeniable staggering dividends of that exact same system, don't they?
They do. They argue that this concentration of technological capital has driven the fastest period of innovation in human history.
It's hard to argue with the results, honestly.
It really is. It has unlocked unprecedented economic growth, optimized global supply chains, and perhaps most importantly, democratized access to information. I mean, an individual in a remote village with a $50 smartphone today has instantaneous access to a larger repository of human knowledge than the president of the United States had 30 years ago.
I always laugh about that because I have more compute power in my pocket than the Apollo missions had, and I mostly use it to look at high-definition videos and people making sourdough bread.
Well, we all have our priorities, right?
Right. But the utility is undeniable. So no. The question isn't really whether this technology is good or bad. That's way too simple. The real question is how these companies got so big so fast without triggering the usual societal immune responses.
Yes.
How did we end up in what the dossier calls the voluntary empire? because that phrasing is just so striking.
The voluntary empire is perhaps the most accurate framing of the 2015 to 2029 era. If we rewind to the early 2000s, the entities we are dissecting today were incredibly small.
Like literal startups.
Exactly. We are talking about startups operating out of university dormitories and suburban garages. Yet, you fast forward 20 years and they boast user bases in the billions.
It's unprecedented growth.
They maintain suboceanic fiber optic cables, they possess financial reserves that dwarf the GDP of medium-sized nations, and they basically mediate our relationships, our commerce, and our politics.
But here's the thing that really bends my mind. Historically, when an entity amassed that level of state-like power, there was usually, well, violence involved.
Or at least some form of coercion, yes.
Right. You got power through military conquest or a bloodline monarchy, or in a modern sense, through the grueling process of democratic elections and taxation. The tech giants didn't roll tanks into our neighborhood.
No, they certainly didn't.
And they didn't levy a mandatory tax on us. We didn't have to use them.
They bypassed traditional state building entirely because their power is rooted in frictionless utility. Mm. We, the citizens, actively and enthusiastically handed over this influence.
Because it was just so convenient.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. We adopted their search engines, their hardware, their communication protocols, because the immediate convenience they offered was simply too good to refuse. We basically entered into a completely new kind of social contract.
Yeah, we clicked I agree on a 50-page terms of service document without reading a single word of it.
I don't think anyone has ever read one all the way through.
Let's be real, absolutely not. And in that one click, we basically traded our behavioral data and our sustained attention in exchange for free routing, free email, and free social connection.
And the compounding effect of billions of people making that exact same voluntary trade created an entirely new, deeply fortified layer of power.
A layer sitting right in the middle of everything.
Right. Traditionally, in political science, you analyze the relationship directly between the citizen and the state. But this era saw the insertion of a massive, data-rich, privately controlled filter sitting squarely between the citizen and their government.
And between the citizen and the rest of the world, really.
Wow.
So let's look at the actual architects of this middle layer. The dossier highlights seven major players that absolutely defined this 15-year stretch. You have Google, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, Amazon, Tesla, and X.
The heavy hitters.
Right. And to understand them, we have to stop thinking of them as just tech companies selling software and start looking at the specific choke points they control.
That is the crucial distinction.
So let's start with what we interact with the most, the visible gatekeepers. First up, Google.
To classify Google as merely a search engine is to fundamentally misunderstand its role in human society.
It's way more than that.
Oh, absolutely. Google functions as the primary epistemological gatekeeper for billions of people. It is literally the lens through which we view the sum total of human knowledge.
Because their architecture spans so much. Right. I mean, you have the search engine, navigational routing through Google Maps.
Right, plus enterprise and personal communication via Gmail, the world's largest video repository in YouTube.
And that invisible, sprawling advertising network that essentially underwrites the economics of the entire free web.
It is the default starting point for human curiosity.
Yeah. If you have a weird medical symptom, you Google it. If you need to figure out how to fix a transmission, you YouTube it. And there is a profoundly beautiful side to this, right?
There is. It democratizes knowledge at a scale that physical libraries could never even attempt to achieve.
But, and this is a huge but, the critical view in the dossier doesn't focus on what Google knows. It focuses on how Google decides to show it to you.
Precisely. The power lies in the sorting mechanism. Google utilizes incomprehensibly complex proprietary machine learning models to index and rank the internet.
The famous algorithm.
Yes. These models weigh thousands of opaque signals to determine what piece of information is most relevant. But relevance is a highly subjective metric disguised as objective mathematics.
That's a great way to put it.
The algorithm quietly prioritizes certain results, establishes authority, and effectively buries competing information.
So it's not just finding information, it's aggressively curating reality. Like, if you and I search the exact same political term, there is a very good chance we get completely different results based on what the algorithm predicts will keep us engaged.
Or what it deems authoritative based on its internal logic, exactly. And that leads to a profound concentration of power.
I mean, if you think about it, if they bury something, it's gone.
Right. If Google's ranking system pushes a specific news outlet, a scientific theory, or a political candidate to page 10 of the search results, for the vast majority of the human population, that entity ceases to exist.
Nobody clicks to page 10.
Nobody even goes to page 2. So Google isn't just a mirror passively reflecting the internet. It is an active, invisible editor shaping our collective perception of reality, and it does so based on parameters they keep highly guarded as trade secrets.
Okay, so that is the gatekeeper of information. Let's pivot to the gatekeeper of access, which is Apple. I always struggle with this one because people usually resort to calling Apple's ecosystem a walled garden.
Which is a bit of a cliche at this point.
Yeah. Feels a bit tired. To me, looking at the structural economics outlined in the dossier, Apple operates more like a high-security corporate nation-state.
That is a much more accurate framework. Apple achieved its dominance by perfectly marrying hardware and software into a closed loop. The iPhone, the Mac, the iOS operating system, these aren't just consumer products.
They're like sovereign digital territories.
Exactly. They are a sovereign territory, and the primary mechanism of this sovereignty is the strict, uncompromising control of the App Store.
And as a user, I totally get why people opt into this dictatorial model. Proponents argue that this closed ecosystem is exactly why an iPhone feels so seamless to use.
It works, and it works well.
Right. Apple is essentially acting as a ruthless border patrol. Every single line of code, every developer, every update has to be inspected and approved by Apple before it is allowed anywhere near your phone.
And the result of that strict control is unparalleled security, fewer malicious apps, and this heavily marketed promise of privacy.
The user experience is undeniably friction-free, but the structural critique raised in the dossier focuses on the sheer market power this affords one single company.
Think of the iPhone not as a phone, but as a mandatory toll road to reach over a billion of the wealthiest consumers on the planet.
And Apple gets to dictate all the rules of commerce on that road.
Right. It's the famous 30% cut. If you want to sell a digital good or a subscription on an iPhone, Apple historically takes a massive percentage of that revenue.
And developers can't just go set up shop somewhere else.
Exactly. They are entirely captive. The tension here is between curated security and monopolistic extraction.
Because critics argue that this architecture fundamentally stifles competition.
It does. If Apple launches a service, say a music app or a fitness tracker, they can inherently prioritize their own software over third-party developers within the ecosystem they own.
They have a total home field advantage.
Absolutely. And if a developer breaks Apple's unilaterally decided rules, they aren't just slapped with a fine. They are excised from half the mobile market in an instant. The power over what digital services are even permitted to exist is entirely centralized in Cupertino.
Wow. Which naturally brings us to the gatekeepers of our actual social fabric, Meta. So we're talking about Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. If Apple built the toll road, Meta essentially engineered the modern digital public square.
But, you know, calling it a public square is actually slightly misleading.
How so?
Because a physical town square is governed by physics and chronology.
Yeah.
If you stand on a soapbox and yell, the people nearest to you hear it. It's linear.
Right.
Meta transformed the social graph into an algorithmic discovery engine. They didn't just digitize human connection. They commodified the attention required to maintain it.
That is a deep distinction. Let's really dig into the mechanics of that, because it goes way, way beyond just sharing vacation photos with your aunt.
Yeah.
The dossier points to how Meta actually rewired political and social behavior.
The underlying mechanism is engagement optimization. Meta's platforms are financially incentivized to keep a user scrolling for as long as theoretically possible.
More scrolling equals more ads seen.
Exactly. To achieve this, the algorithms do not just show you a chronological feed of what your friends are doing. Instead, they use highly sophisticated predictive behavioral modeling.
So they are guessing what we want to see.
More than guessing. The system dynamically scores content based on the probability that it will elicit a reaction from you, whether that's a like, a comment, a share, or even just a micro pause in your scrolling.
And psychologically speaking, the things that make humans pause aren't typically calm, nuanced policy debates.
Unfortunately not.
It's high arousal emotion, it's awe, and far more often it's anger, outrage, and affective polarization.
Which fundamentally alters the incentive structure for any public figure operating today. If you are a journalist, an activist, or a politician in this era, you quickly realize that measured discourse is heavily penalized by the algorithm with low visibility.
You just won't be seen.
Right. Conversely, inflammatory rhetoric, out-of-context outrage, and highly polarized content are rewarded with massive, frictionless amplification. The medium inherently shapes the message.
So it isn't necessarily that Meta sat down in a boardroom and set out to divide society. It's that their optimization metrics, maximizing time on device, accidentally discovered that human tribalism is just the most efficient fuel for ad revenue.
That is exactly the crux of the controversy. By engineering an engagement machine, they inadvertently created an infrastructure capable of accelerating the rapid spread of disinformation, destabilizing local elections, and fracturing shared reality.
It's like the tool built to connect the world proved equally capable of hyperfragmenting it.
Perfectly stated.
Okay, so those are the highly visible front doors of the internet.
Yeah.
Google, Apple, Meta. We interact with them constantly. But if we are mapping the true power structure of this digital state, we have to look underground.
Yes, the foundational layer.
We have to look at the concrete foundations, the invisible infrastructure that keeps the entire city from collapsing. So let's talk about Microsoft and Amazon.
It is a critical pivot. While the consumer-facing companies were embroiled in highly public controversies over screen time and social polarization, Microsoft and Amazon were quietly entrenching themselves as the absolute structural bedrock of the global economy.
Let's start with Microsoft. Because for a while there, it really felt like Microsoft was missing the mobile revolution. They weren't winning the smartphone wars at all.
No, they lost that battle decisively.
But the dossier frames them as the quiet giant. Their power isn't in what consumers do for fun on their phones. It's in how human beings actually conduct business.
Microsoft basically operates as the central nervous system of global administration. Through the omnipresence of the Windows operating system and the entrenched dependency on the Microsoft Office suite, they hold structural leverage over almost every bureaucracy, educational institution, and corporate enterprise on the planet.
Right. Everyone uses Word and Excel.
No.
But the true pivot in this era wasn't just legacy software, was it?
No, it was the massive migration to the cloud.
Right. It's not just having an Excel file saved on your desktop anymore. It's Microsoft Azure.
Azure, along with their incredibly aggressive early investments in artificial intelligence infrastructure, transformed Microsoft from a software vendor into a cognitive utility.
A cognitive utility?
They are providing the underlying computing power and the AI models that other companies use to build their own futures. They essentially provide the very fabric of digital labor.
Which perfectly transitions us to the absolute titan of invisible infrastructure, Amazon. And I always find this wild, because when you say Amazon to the average person, they picture a brown cardboard box on their porch, right? Or maybe an e-reader.
Of course, the retail side is what everyone sees.
But the retail business, while massively successful, isn't the true core of their digital hegemony. It's Amazon Web Services, AWS.
AWS represents a paradigm shift in how the internet physically operates. Historically, if a company wanted to run a website or an application, they had to physically purchase servers.
Which was incredibly expensive.
Very expensive. They had to store them in a climate-controlled room and hire a team to maintain them. It was a massive capital expenditure. But Amazon recognized that they could virtualize this entire process.
So what did they do?
They built immense global networks of data centers and began renting out computing power, storage, and networking as a dynamically scalable utility.
It essentially turned computer servers into electricity. You just plug it to the wall, use what you need, and pay the monthly bill.
Exactly like electricity.
But let's look at the incredible dependency that creates.
The dependency is absolute. AWS is the dominant provider of cloud infrastructure globally. This means that a staggering percentage of the internet, from streaming services and banking applications to logistical networks and independent startups, is physically running on Amazon's hardware.
The dossier highlights this incredible concentration of risk. I mean, what actually happens when municipal governments, defense contractors, and hospitals entirely outsource their digital operations to Amazon servers?
It creates a scenario where Amazon is no longer merely a participant in the free market. They are effectively the landlord of the digital economy.
The landlord?
Yes. If AWS experiences a regional outage, major portions of the global economy simply cease to function until Amazon resolves the issue.
So entire countries could grind to a halt because one private company's server farm goes down.
Exactly. The economic and operational reliance of sovereign states on a private retail and logistics company is an unprecedented historical anomaly.
It's the ultimate invisible choke point. All right, so we've examined the infrastructure and the gatekeepers. Now we have to talk about the loud companies.
Highly visible ones.
Yeah, the entities where the platform and the personality of the leader are completely indistinguishable. Let's dive into the cult of personality and the battle for the public square, focusing heavily on Tesla and X.
This dynamic represents a fascinating cultural evolution during this period. Hmm. In previous eras, a corporate CEO's primary mandate was to, you know, optimize supply chains, maximize shareholder returns, and studiously avoid political controversy.
Stay out of the news, basically.
Right. But companies like Tesla and X exemplify a radical blurring of the lines between industrial capital, personal brand, and geopolitical influence.
Let's unpack Tesla first. Because obviously, in the context of global power shifts, we aren't just talking about the aerodynamics of a sleek electric car.
Yeah.
We are talking about the CEO acting as a quasi-state actor.
Tesla's integration of advanced manufacturing, battery supply chains, and space launch infrastructure through affiliated companies created a very unique leverage point.
Yeah, I feel like.
But what the dossier specifically highlights is how the leadership of these entities bypassed traditional media completely. They established direct, unmediated lines of communication with tens or hundreds of millions of citizens.
It's the total disintermediation of PR and politics.
Yeah.
A tech leader in this era didn't need to hold a press conference or issue some polished corporate statement.
Not at all.
A single unfiltered post on social media could arbitrarily move financial markets, dictate the global news cycle for a week, or literally spark a diplomatic incident with a foreign government.
They leveraged their personal platforms to act as cultural lightning rods and policy opinion makers. And this direct communication strategy inherently leads us to the specific architecture of the platform where the majority of this friction occurred.
Which is X, the network formerly known as Twitter. Now, X is structurally fascinating to me because compared to the active user base of Meta or Google, X is relatively small, right?
Yes, a fraction of the size.
But its geopolitical footprint is disproportionately massive.
It functions as the central nervous system for the political and media elite. X is the real-time collision point for journalists, state actors, activists, and highly engaged citizens.
It's where the narrative gets formed.
It is the defining battlefield for public narrative. And because of this asymmetrical influence, its ownership transitions and moderation policies during the 2015 to 2029 era became the absolute focal point for the broader debate over how a digital public square should be governed.
Okay, let's break down the mechanics of this debate impartially, because this is where the societal fault lines truly fractured in the dossier.
Yeah.
What are the two core philosophical camps battling over the governance of X?
It is a profound clash of democratic values. On one side, you have the fundamentalist proponents of open expression.
The free speech absolutists, right?
Their argument is rooted in the belief that an unfiltered, highly decentralized flow of information is the lifeblood of a free society. In their view, allowing a centralized private authority to act as an arbiter of truth, basically dictating what is and is not acceptable speech, is a far more dangerous threat to democracy than the speech itself.
Their position is essentially a digital update to the classic liberal free speech doctrine. Like, the only cure for bad or misleading speech is more speech openly debated in the public square.
Precisely. They argue that protecting dissenting, controversial, and even deeply offensive viewpoints is a necessary friction in a free society. However, on the opposing side, you have proponents of strict structural moderation. Their argument is that these platforms are fundamentally not traditional public squares. They are algorithmic amplification engines.
Right. They argue that freedom of speech does not automatically guarantee freedom of reach.
Exactly. This camp argues that companies possess a profound civic responsibility to aggressively limit the friction-free spread of organized disinformation, coordinated harassment, and hate speech.
Because it's not just talk anymore.
No, they argue that when viral falsehoods, whether about public health protocols or the integrity of a democratic election, are allowed to spread organically unchecked, they inevitably result in tangible physical harm in the real world.
So they view strict moderation not as draconian censorship, but as basic digital hygiene, just a total necessity to protect the integrity of the civic ecosystem.
And the dossier treats both sets of concerns as highly valid and structurally unresolved. Which brings us directly to the threshold of the most controversial mechanics of this era.
The invisible lines of censorship and the profound influence of algorithms on human autonomy. Let's push into the actual mechanics of this censorship dilemma, because the word gets thrown around constantly, but we really need to define it structurally. When does network moderation cross the line into systemic censorship?
That is the incredibly delicate line these corporations are forced to walk. In a traditional constitutional sense, censorship is an action taken by a sovereign state against its citizens.
Right, like the First Amendment in the U.S. restricts government action, not private action.
Exactly. But in the digital era, we see private megacorporations acting as the primary arbiters of acceptable public discourse.
Right. And the platforms have a clear business imperative to moderate. I mean, if an app becomes completely overrun with malicious bots, spam, and unhinged threats, the median user leaves and the ad revenue collapses.
Yeah, it's bad for business.
Right. So they implement massive teams and AI classifiers to scrub the worst content. But the critics argue that this process rapidly suffers from mission creep.
The critique focuses heavily on how these platforms define terms like safety or misinformation. Critics argue that under the guise of user protection, these entities frequently restrict valid, albeit highly contentious, political debate.
And it's not always obvious, right? The mechanics of this restriction are often completely opaque. It is rarely a clear-cut deletion of a post.
No, it's far more subtle than that.
It's the shadow banning, the algorithmic throttling.
Exactly. It is visibility filtering. A platform can simply adjust the algorithmic weight of a specific user or topic, ensuring their content never appears in anyone's recommendation feed without ever officially notifying the user.
They just shout into the void.
Right. This grants a handful of executives and software engineers the unprecedented capability to quietly wipe a political movement or a dissenting scientific theory from the digital consciousness of billions.
Which naturally forces us to ask the ultimate governance question: who watches the watchers? If a private company controls the only viable infrastructure for public debate, do they effectively become a state actor?
That is the core legal and philosophical dilemma.
Do they owe their users constitutional rights, or are they just managing a private digital mall?
And you cannot fully answer that question without completely examining the automated systems doing the managing. We have to analyze the cognitive impact of predictive modeling, the algorithms.
Okay, I always hear this framing that algorithms are brainwashing us. But I want to push back on that for a second based on the dossier. Aren't these algorithms essentially just highly efficient mirrors?
Well, they are mirrors, but...
Because, I mean, if an algorithm shows a user a steady stream of outrage, isn't that simply because the user keeps clicking on outrage? Isn't the machine just giving us what we fundamentally want?
It is a sophisticated mirror, yes, but it is a funhouse mirror that distorts reality to maximize a specific metric.
Okay, explain that.
The algorithm does not just passively reflect your interests. It actively probes your psychological vulnerabilities. It calculates billions of data points.
Like what?
Like how long your thumb hovers over an image, what time of day you engage with certain topics, your exact geolocation relative to other users. It uses all of this to construct a highly predictive model of your cognition.
So it isn't just reacting to me, it's actively anticipating me.
It anticipates and then feeds back. And this creates a profound feedback loop. If the algorithm detects that you are even slightly sympathetic to a fringe political theory, it will incrementally feed you content that validates and intensifies that sympathy.
Just because that content yields higher engagement.
Exactly.
So we get into the real debate about cognitive autonomy here. If an AI is constantly curating my reality to push my emotional buttons, gradually shifting the baseline of what I consider normal political discourse, who is actually driving my political evolution? Me or the optimization function of the machine?
That is the defining sociological debate of the dossier. Some researchers argue these algorithms create radicalizing echo chambers that actively fracture societal consensus.
And others.
Others argue the technology simply amplifies pre-existing human tribalism. But the universal consensus is that these algorithms are not neutral observers. They are active, structural participants in shaping democratic outcomes.
Okay, so let's zoom out for a second. We have these massive privately owned systems that control the flow of information, run the physical infrastructure of the internet, and actively shape human behavior through predictive modeling.
A staggering amount of power.
Truly. So if you are a government leader, say, sitting in a parliament somewhere in Europe, and you suddenly realize that your entire sovereign economy and the daily cognitive diet of your citizens are completely dependent on five or six companies based in California, how do you respond?
It's a terrifying realization for a sovereign state.
It has to be. Which brings us to one of the most fascinating geopolitical shifts in the dossier: Europe's quest for digital sovereignty.
The European perspective is absolutely vital to understanding the global pushback of this era. Over the course of these 15 years, a palpable existential anxiety swept through the European bloc.
Because they were so far behind.
Right. Europe possessed highly advanced manufacturing, excellent engineering, and strong automotive sectors. But they looked at the digital landscape and realized they had completely missed the boat.
They realized they were essentially operating as a digital colony. I mean, European citizens were searching on an American engine, communicating on American social graphs, storing their government data on American cloud servers, and buying apps through an American walled garden.
That realization fueled a massive, coordinated legislative strategy to achieve what they termed digital sovereignty or digital autonomy.
Okay.
How? The European Union understood that they could not simply conjure a European Google or a European Apple out of thin air to compete on scale. However, they possessed one massive piece of leverage.
The market, yes.
A highly lucrative, unified market of 450 million wealthy consumers.
So they basically use market access as a weapon. Like, if you can't build the game, you use your market power to forcibly rewrite the rule book of the game. So what were the specific mechanics of this regulatory arsenal?
The EU sought to impose democratic public control over private market dynamics. The dossier focuses heavily on three pioneering legislative instruments that defined the European response.
Let's walk through them.
The first was the Digital Services Act, or the DSA. This targeted the societal impact of the platforms. It legally forced massive tech companies to provide transparency into how their algorithms functioned.
Oh, so basically outlawing the black box.
Exactly. It mandated strict protocols for how they must handle illegal content and required them to open their data to independent researchers.
Saying, if you operate in our borders, you have to show us the math behind your engagement models. That's huge. What was the second one?
The second instrument was the Digital Markets Act, the DMA. This was an aggressive structural attack on the gatekeeper power we discussed earlier. The DMA explicitly targeted the walled gardens.
Like Apple.
Right. It sought to legally force interoperability and prevent platforms from unfairly preferencing their own integrated services over smaller competitors.
Wait, let's explore the mechanics of that. Does that mean forcing Apple to allow a third-party app store on the iPhone? Because if regulators force Apple to completely open its ecosystem, aren't they inherently breaking the security model that makes the iPhone valuable in the first place?
That is a very common concern.
Aren't they just legislating iOS into becoming Android?
That is precisely the counterargument utilized by the tech companies themselves. They argued the DMA would fundamentally degrade user security and privacy.
And how did Europe respond?
The European regulators countered that true security should not require a monopolistic chokehold on market access. The DMA attempted to pry open these ecosystems, mandating things like allowing smaller messaging apps to interoperate with dominant ones like WhatsApp in an attempt to shatter the network effects that keep users locked in.
So basically a forced decentralization. Wow. And what was the third piece of this regulatory puzzle?
The AI Act. This was an ambitious early attempt to preemptively regulate the next frontier of computing.
Right, getting ahead of it for once.
Exactly. Rather than reacting after the fact, the AI Act attempted to categorize artificial intelligence systems based on the precise level of risk they pose to human rights and safety.
So treating different AI differently based on what it actually does.
Right. Banning certain applications entirely, like untargeted facial recognition scraping, and imposing massive compliance requirements on high-risk AI models.
So the European Union aggressively positioned itself as the global regulatory superpower. It's that classic Brussels effect, right? Hoping that if tech companies change their code to comply in Europe, they'll just apply those changes globally because it's easier.
Exactly, and it often works.
But the dossier also points out that regulation wasn't their only strategy. There was a huge grassroots push for actual European alternatives. Let's look at the tech they actually tried to build to replace the American giants.
While the legislation represented a top-down mandate for sovereignty, the emergence of alternative technologies represented a bottom-up, citizen-led desire for a different architectural model entirely.
Right. So against the massive data harvesting machine of Google search, you saw the rise of European options like Quant out of France.
Which structurally refuses to track user search history.
Or Ecosia in Germany, which directs its search revenue toward ecological projects.
And in the realm of digital communication, as a counterweight to Gmail's massive ecosystem, you had the rapid growth of ProtonMail in Switzerland.
And how does that work differently?
Their underlying architecture is fundamentally different. They utilize zero-knowledge, end-to-end encryption, ensuring that not even the company itself can scan or monetize the contents of a user's inbox.
A total shift away from the surveillance model. And what about that invisible infrastructure we talked about, the cloud?
To mitigate the profound sovereign risk of relying entirely on AWS or Microsoft Azure, European governments and enterprises actively subsidized and promoted localized cloud providers.
Like who?
Like OVH Cloud in France and IONOS Cloud in Germany. The goal was to ensure that critical European data, from healthcare records to state secrets, physically remained on servers located within European legal jurisdiction.
Making it immune to foreign subpoenas, basically.
Precisely.
And finally, in the absolute chaos of the social media wars, against the centralized control of Meta and X, we saw the fascinating rise of federated networks like Mastodon.
The mechanics of Mastodon are crucial here. It doesn't operate on a single massive corporate server.
Right. It's not just one big building of servers somewhere.
No, it operates on an open source protocol called ActivityPub. It functions much like email, a decentralized federation of thousands of independent servers that can all communicate with one another.
Meaning no single CEO or board of directors can dictate the rules of the entire network or radically alter the algorithmic feed for everyone.
Exactly. It decentralizes the power back to the communities.
Now, let's be totally pragmatic about this for a second. Mastodon has not bankrupted X. Quant is not going to put Google out of business next week. These European alternatives are, by every statistical metric of market share and daily active users, vastly smaller than their American counterparts.
That is an undeniable market reality. They are much smaller.
So do they actually matter?
However, as the dossier emphasizes, their scale does not negate their historical significance. These platforms act as vital proofs of concept.
Showing that it can be done.
Yes. They demonstrate that the American model of hyperscaled surveillance capitalist technology is not the only viable architecture for the digital age. They symbolize a persistent, structural yearning for a digital ecosystem that prioritizes local jurisdiction, fundamental privacy rights, and democratic governance over unconstrained corporate growth.
They are basically planting a flag in the digital soil and proving that a different kind of internet is mathematically and structurally possible.
Exactly.
All right, as we pull back the lens on this massive, complex landscape we have mapped out today,
sure.
How do we synthesize the core takeaway from Chapter 7? What is the defining truth of this entire 2015 to 2029 era?
The overarching synthesis of this period is that the very nature of human governance permanently fractured.
Fire up your how.
Traditional nation states are no longer the sole, or even perhaps the primary, arbiters of global power. These technological entities, armed with unprecedented repositories of behavioral data, sprawling physical infrastructures, and advanced algorithmic models, have successfully established themselves as a permanent, non-state layer of global authority.
They built the voluntary empire, and we all just kind of moved in.
We did. We moved right in. And the ultimate lesson of the dossier is that this is not a conversation about regression. We cannot put the technological genie back into the bottle, nor should we even wish to abandon the extraordinary utility these systems provide.
Right. Nobody wants to give up their smartphone or Google Maps.
Exactly. The defining challenge of the 21st century is not stopping the technology. It is entirely about inventing new democratic frameworks, regulatory mechanisms, and civic checks and balances that are actually capable of governing this new reality.
Which brings us to the final lingering question that I want you, the listener, to really mull over as you go about the rest of your day. Think about the platforms you log into, the algorithms that curate your news, the invisible servers housing your personal data. Ask yourself, in our modern digital society, who actually wields the power of governance?
Is it the democratic institutions you elect?
Is it you, the sovereign consumer, through your daily behavioral choices? Or is it the silent, mathematically optimized code running inside those distant data centers?
The answer to that structural question will undoubtedly dictate the trajectory and health of free societies for generations to come.
It is a staggering amount to process. And remarkably, the shifting tectonic plates of global power in this dossier don't stop with silicon and software.
No, they certainly do not.
Before we wrap up, I want to look ahead to the next section of our journey through the Trump 2015-2029 dossier. Next time in Chapter 8, we are taking a massive pivot from digital bits back to physical atoms and global capital. We are diving into America First and global trade.
It will be an equally disruptive exploration. We are going to analyze the precise mechanics of the trade wars, the strategic implementation of import tariffs, and really unravel the intense economic blockades involving China, the European bloc, Canada, and Mexico.
We're going to bypass the typical political spin and look directly at the balance sheets to figure out exactly which domestic industries flourished, which global supply chains broke off completely, and who ultimately paid the price during this radical overhaul of the global economy. You absolutely will not want to miss it.
It's going to be a deep one.
Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. It is an absolute privilege to untangle these massive systemic architectures with you. The next time you wake up and blindly swipe a notification off that piece of glass in your hand, I want you to take just one fraction of a second to recognize the vast invisible empire operating right beneath your fingertips. Until next time, keep diving deep.